then when this Herman Junkin objects to her staying at the Saddlery, he's going to sell it. It's in Bridge Road. The building's still there. She tries to poison him, and that's when they find enough arsenic in the cup of tea she gives him to kill him five times over.
This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Mother, murderer, victim. The story of Martha Needle is compelling and tragic. We speak to author Dr. Brian Williams about his in-depth book about the life and crimes of this woman who is one of Australia's worst female killers. Very pleased to have you here today, Dr. Brian Williams, to talk about your quite, I found it quite extraordinary book about Martha Needle, and you've called her the spell, it's called The Spellbinding Story of Australia's Most Infamous Femme Fatale. Now, this is a historic crime story, but Martha really does have quite a place in Australian history. First of all, I want to talk to you about who is Martha Needle and why. Why did this story intrigue you so much?
With Martha Needle, as with a lot of historical research, you move into it while sometimes you're studying other things. And I was aware that there'd been five women executed in the history of Victoria, which in comparison to the number of men that had been executed, it was a relatively low number. And I knew that three of them had been executed within a period of about 12 months. So that intrigued me in terms of why there'd been a sudden rash of female executions in comparison to the rest of history. So that led me to go back and look at these cases. And I had been aware of Martha Needle. I'd seen her name in a lot of history books and a lot of books on crime. And I was aware that she had been involved in what appeared to be multiple cases of murder. And it was when I started to move into her case more and more that I became quite intrigued and almost to the point of being quite passionate about her story. And part of that was she was just such an incredibly manipulating and cagey type of criminal. And I managed to find a lot of records where we were dealing with her direct correspondence and words that directly came from her, all of them pretty badly written, badly spelled, but nonetheless they showed me just how manipulating she could be, and that intrigued me as to how she became that way. So then I started to look into the background of Martha Needle, and it really was a fascinating journey to go on. And there's a couple of very significant things about it. One of them is her particular background, which is sometimes the sort of thing that's lost in history. And what I mean by that is how she became the sort of person she ended up being.
That's what, when I was reading the book, that really profoundly affected how I read on. But I just felt like we read with crime, we read the end result, but you're right, the start of it is so different. And I was... She had an absolutely devastating upbringing.
She absolutely did, yeah. And there were a number of factors in her life, and I can certainly happy to go through those with you in a moment as we speak about it further. The other aspect of Martha that I found to be fascinating was just the sheer amount of crime that we were talking about. She was executed, and perhaps we'll talk about, you know, the horrors of execution at some stage too, but that was for one murder. That was for the murder of her brother-in-law. But what I managed to find as we move through the cases and move through all of the evidence, and I am talking about a copious amount of documents here in terms of records and public records and public court records, was that while she'd been executed for one murder, there's little doubt that she was a serial killer and had in fact murdered a very large number of people in proportion to other persons who had been executed. And look, the sad truth is that she's murdered her husband, but also her own children. We're talking about three children here. And there was even the scientific evidence available for quite a number of people that would show that. But then there was other evidence that helped line it up. Now, just to put that in context, we're talking a minimum of four murders, but as we move further along the line, it's probably six plus would be a more accurate figure, which puts Martha Needle at the top of the leaderboard, unfortunately, in terms of certainly as a poisoner. She's the worst poisoner that's been captured in Victorian history. There may have been others or in Australian history. But you talk about the number of murders committed by females. She's right up the top now in terms of Australian history as well. And she even sits on one of the leaderboards in the world history when a person gets up to those sort of numbers. And this was all in a remarkably short space of time. And all the time, she was a manipulating sort of an actress. She had the community wrapped around her finger, feeling sorry for her. She was very, very good at playing a role that she wanted to play. She was very good at manipulating men. She had doctors wrapped around her finger who she seemed to be able to get them to write anything she really wanted them to write on a death certificate. She had all the neighbours on her side. She had a lot of things going for her when it came to getting people to do things she wanted them to do.
I've highlighted in the book, there was a particular line that your writing is really fantastic and this book is a great read. But this is talking about, you know, most men in her presence would afford her an admiring second glance, and she soon learned to always reward their attentions with an endearing smile. She came to learn that her charm was the only power she had. And why I found that so startling is, if you set for us the time that Martha was around and why, you know, women were in a very powerless situation, weren't they, especially
Absolutely.
Martha. So set for the listeners, what time are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about the 1880s and 1890s. Now, Martha was executed in 1894, and that was very quick. It's one of the few times I think the laws acted so efficiently. It was very, very quick. She was only arrested in June, and by October the same year she'd been executed. So we'd gone to two trials at that stage. You are correct in that this was a time when women were very disempowered in all sorts of ways, even worse for Martha Needle. And we might just think about some of the factors in her early life, because once again, this gives us a proper picture of the sort of person that we're dealing with. And it's always easy to end with the end result in crime, but I think the fascination of it is looking at the causes. Mm. People weren't quite as concerned about the causes in the 1890s,
and no,
they were worried
imagine.
About the end result. But Martha Needle could not have had a worse childhood if we sat here now and tried to develop one for a criminal template. Now, to give you a bit of an idea, she was born into poverty in South Australia. Her parents were pretty much horrible people. They were criminals. They were drunks. They featured in all of the newspapers almost on a daily basis, being locked up for drunk and disorderly and abusing police and abusing everybody. Look, she had a very abusive childhood. And when I say abusive, there was certainly evidence that I managed to find that, you know, she was the subject of physical abuse, the subject of mental abuse, emotional abuse, certainly neglect. This is a time when children went hungry. But what made it even worse is her natural father died. He was a bit of a rotter anyway. But then her mother took off with an army deserter who was a drunken criminal as well. And look, I managed to find some records that indicated that at the age of 12, Martha had been raped by that person, and it appeared as though it was a series of crimes that had been committed for a period of time. And the depth of that particular attack was so bad, he ended up copping the maximum penalty available to the judge at that time, which was only 2 years. Mm. So we're talking about an era when childhood was treated quite cheaply.
And it was actually a neighbour, wasn't it, who intervened, which would have been unusual back then for people to sort of step into.
I would suggest so. And I think that whoever was brave enough to step in and do the statement would have done so under all sorts of threats, I would have thought. Mm. But it was a horrifying case. But also it was just symptomatic of what Martha had been living through all of her life, I would suggest. Now, from there she moved out, and at the age of 12 she started work as a servant girl, working in richer houses. So she was the sort of maid you see dressed up in period dramas nowadays. Mm. And looks like, I think that might have just planted a bit of a seed in Martha Needle. She suddenly saw the other side of life and what people could do with money and they could do with influence. And she liked the finer things, I think, even though she was the one doing the washing. She liked the fine clothes and she liked the fancy furniture, and she had a seed planted in her mind for a more ambitious life than where she'd come from. But things didn't really go her way from that point of view. She fell pregnant to a local builder who was 5 or 6 years older than her, a person by the name of Henry Needle, and was married quite young. So by the time she's 18, she's married. That's not unusual for women in that age, of course, but it wasn't destined to be a happy union. They did have a child soon after, a daughter by the name of Mabel, and then they moved from South Australia to Richmond, Now, to give you an idea of Richmond, we're not that far from Richmond where we sit here, I guess. But
I used to live in Richmond in the 1990s. Yeah. I wish I'd bought the flat that I used to rent.
Bet you did. Yeah. Because what I was going to say, and I wasn't just going to talk about real estate, Richmond in the 1890s, some of it wasn't too bad. There was a little bit of a gentry side of things, but pretty much it was a bit of a slum area that was used for factories and used for the workers of the factories, and that's where the Needles went to live with other people who were similar to them. She then had another couple of children fairly quickly, two daughters. So she ended up with three daughters. The marriage collapsed, but a lot of it seemed to be because Martha had developed a roaming eye for the good things of life, mm-hmm. and she'd certainly developed a roving eye for a lot of the local men in the community. I could probably be a little bit less polite about that, but there was ample evidence to show that she was attracting a lot of attention and seemed to appreciate that.
Yeah.
And she used to like to dress up in the finest clothes and walk up and down the main shopping strips of Richmond. To a point that most people who knew her at that time thought she'd come from a pretty high station in life, yeah. whereas in fact she hadn't done so. Now, as the marriage collapsed, there's certainly evidence that domestic violence started to move into the scene. There were witnesses who were available later who would indicate that Henry Needle, in jealousy, had started to dish out some physical punishment to Martha too. So you can imagine she's in a terrible situation.
Yeah.
She's broke. She doesn't appreciate that at all. She's living in Richmond. She's with a man she doesn't want to be with. She's come from a violent background and now she's the victim of more violence. It's just not what she wanted. She starts to fall into all sorts of unusual behaviours at this time, but most of it's involving manipulating other people.
What was she getting out of the what was her end game with this?
She certainly liked financial gain, yeah. out of everything she could. So she'd learned from her own family that charity was a good way to go. In her childhood, charity was just about the only income her family would have had. So she still certainly sought out every charitable source that she could. Yeah. But she started to take a patent medicine. And when I say patent medicine, this was an era when you could buy anything over the counter at any chemist store, what were then grocer stores. And the patent medicine that she fell for was a medicine called Chlorodyne. And the patent medicines, they weren't registered, so they could have anything in them. And they used to make all sorts of outlandish claims as to what they could cure every known ailment to mankind. And Chlorodyne had morphine in it. It also had cannabis and chloroform. So it was a pretty nasty hit. And
sounds pretty full on.
It featured in a lot of suicides in those days, and it also featured in a lot of accidental deaths. People would overdose on this stuff, and it became addictive.
Sounds extremely addictive to have that combination.
And it could result in bizarre-type behaviours. So that didn't help Martha's cause one iota. The other thing that seemed to be moving through the book all the way through, her mental health, particularly later on in her marriage, and this was probably after she'd already started committing her crimes, that she was subject to sort of fainting fits.
Mm-hmm.
Which could have been epilepsy, but it also could have been a byproduct of guzzling bottles of Chlorodyne.
Yeah.
That would have presented those sort of symptoms with her. So her mental health was all over the shop as well. And you mentioned before what a male-dominated system that we're talking about. That's never more evident than in the justice system that she would later face. Now, when I say it's male-dominated, just understand here that all the police are male. Mm. In the 1880s and 90s, and fairly judgmental sort of males too at that, many of them. We're talking about a different era in policing that time, so we're not talking about DNA and not even fingerprints were available at that time. So the male detectives would be going off their intuition and going off their powers of deduction, very much Sherlock Holmes type stuff. Interviews and some of them may not have been all that honourable as both the people they've taken the interviews off, but also the police who were then interpreting them. Mm. And we weren't in the era of recorded proper criminal procedure interviews.
Yeah. You won't read your rights.
The temptation to just add a few words onto the end of what the person said was obviously there. All the judges were male. All the court officials were male. All the court reporters were male. And even to the next level down, all of the persons on a jury had to be male, so there was no female jurors. And then if something went really bad and the administration had to step in, which certainly happened in terms of Martha, all the politicians were male. So she was facing a male world, and when they were confronted with the ghastly tale of what she'd done, they didn't provide Martha with any comfort whatsoever. Mm. In fact, she didn't get much grace at all. And as I said, the thing that struck me about this case, well, there were two things in particular. If you study something for long enough, but if you do proper historical research, it's very important you put it in the context of its time. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you don't look back in too much judgment as to what is in play now, but you look at what was in play at the time. And she was living, the 1890s was the worst depression that Australia had ever known. Most people know of the 1930s depression, you know, the classic case of people jumping off buildings in Wall Street and things like that. Yeah. But the 1890s depression was the worst known. And, of course, places like Richmond couldn't have been hit harder. Mm. They only needed the factory to close and there'd be 20 families out on the street that night.
Yeah.
So those three executions I spoke about, three of the five, all occurred then.
Okay.
And it was linked to a number of things. It was linked to a fear amongst politicians that there was about to be a rampage in crime, all of these impoverished people becoming even more impoverished, that there would be an outrageous level of crime.
Yeah.
Children were very hard to look after in the 1890s. All of the orphanages were completely crammed and weren't mm-hmm. taking any more people. There were baby farmers everywhere who were all unscrupulous. There was kids literally left in the gutter and hoping mm-hmm. someone would come and pick them up. You couldn't give a child away if you didn't want a child at that time. So there was a feeling that there needed to be some protection put in place for children. So, and I'll talk a moment about Martha Needle, unfortunately, murdered her own children. But also the speed with which all this occurred, and it probably happened way too quickly. As I said before, she was arrested in June 1894. Four bodies were exhumed after that, and she went through two trials. One of them was the police court trial, which mm-hmm. we'd now call a committal hearing. Went 38 witnesses, so it went for a number of days. And then she had a Supreme Court trial. That was all over by September, and within 3 weeks she was executed. Now, the authorities were in such a rush to deal with Martha Needle and make a lesson of her. The case was pretty sloppy because they would have only needed to do a little bit more work and they would have uncovered or they would have dealt with three or four or five other murders as well. And they even had the data in front of them to do that. But they're in such a rush to have her executed and make a lesson of her.
Yep.
That they didn't really go back and do that, which is a bit of an injustice for the victims involved.
Yeah, so, I mean, she would have got executed anyway had they done more delving and found the other victims.
You would think so, yes.
So who were the other victims? Who did she kill?
Yeah, well, we can probably go in a process of reverse engineering, if you like, and sometimes that's the best way to go. She'd already murdered well and truly and got away with it before she was actually caught. And the way she was caught is, her brother-in-law, the person who she was initially charged with murder over, was a person called Louis Yunkin. Now, he was a saddler. The Yunkin family, by the way, were a very well-known family from South Australia, and he died of vague symptoms, and there was all sorts of lodge doctors providing all sorts of certificates. But then after he died, his other brother, a person by the name of Herman Yunkin, this is all in 1894, came to shut down the saddlery. Now, Martha was working there at the time. She was working as the house lady, if you like, who was looking after boarders at that place, and they were about to shut that down. She then attempted to murder him as well, but this time she was caught. He fell very ill and on a number of occasions and eventually went to a different doctor to the doctors that Martha had been sweet-talking to, and there was a range of them. There was a stable of them, in fact. This other doctor was suspicious and he ordered some tests to be made, and he found that he had copious vomiting at that stage, and the vomiting had a massive amount of arsenic in it. They found arsenic in the vomit. So from that point they went to the police, and the police started to work backwards from there, and they realised that Louis Yunkin, his brother who had just died a few weeks earlier, that was suspicious as well. But we can go back further than that, because Martha's three children and her husband had also died only a year or so before that. So maybe what we'll do is we'll roll all the way back, if that's all right.
Yeah.
And we'll go in chronological order as best we can.
After the break, we find out about Martha's court case that was, at the time, one of the highest profile trials in Australia. I'm curious to find out how they explained away the death of the children and the husband.
Well, that's what we'll do. So I've told you that she got away with it, and unfortunately then she got caught for something and they went backwards. In 1885, the last week of 1885, her eldest daughter Mabel, who was 3 years of age, withered away and died. And she had a very quick funeral on New Year's Eve in 1885. Now, that doctor who was, he's a distracted doctor, I might add, who provided the death certificate, was quite troubled by the symptoms. He couldn't figure out what had happened. But in the 1880s and 1890s, autopsies were conducted, but hardly ever.
Mm.
There needed to be a good reason to do it. So that happened in 1885. Now, I'd already mentioned to you that Martha had lost admiration for her husband. We move on a few more years. She's now got two more daughters. Mm. In 1889, her husband Henry, who was in a jealous rage, and she was, there's little doubt she was playing around with a lot of the boarders that they had at their place. He started to fall very ill, but before that, he'd mysteriously taken out a £200 life insurance. Now, the currency of £200 in the 1890s, it's, you're probably talking a couple of houses at least, probably half the street.
Yeah,
it was an enormous amount of money to have as a life insurance policy. Within a short time of taking out that policy, he's back at Richmond living with Martha, and he starts to fall very, very ill. Very mysterious. He was only 30 years of age and had always been very healthy. The doctors come and they look at Henry many, many times. They seem to spend more time talking with Martha than looking at the patient, and she was quite happy with that arrangement as well, I think. He dies. Martha's now, if you like, the Black Widow, and that was one of the nicknames that the press would later give her. She dresses in mourning clothes and receives a lot of sympathy throughout the community. She's now a single mother with two young children to look after, no husband for income. She's just got a few boarders at their house that she's looking after. What people didn't know is that she's madly trying to collect the £200, and within a day of his death, she's sending letters to the insurance company to collect the £200. So she's actually quite happy about, for two reasons. She's happy because she doesn't have Henry anymore to worry about. And the other thing is she's just won Tats Lotto in terms of finances. So he's buried and she's got away with that one. The next year, her second daughter, who's a young girl called Elsie, who's 6 years of age, starts to fall ill with the same symptoms. So this is now in 1890. Same doctor comes along, has the same level of confusion. Elsie dies. He writes the same type of certificate with vague symptoms. So Elsie's now buried in the same grave as her father. Martha now collects her section of the £200 as well, and she's also insured her other two daughters. Mm. So she collects a nice little insurance bounty out of that as well. Her third daughter is 4 years of age and dies the next year. I probably don't need to tell you, from very similar symptoms to what the other two daughters showed.
They look like such sweet little children. You've got a photo
of them.
Yeah,
well,
I've
managed
to
find some photos of them. And so she's also buried. Now, with each of these, Martha is playing up to the community. She's putting huge advertisements in the newspaper. She's trying to have very large funerals. But she's also writing love poems to her children and building memorials to them. So she puts a big poem in the Age newspaper, it's in the front of the book, where she's bemoaning her loss and how she'll never get over the loss of her children. The family are all buried at Kew Burundara Cemetery, and I've had quite a lot to do with the historical group that involved in that cemetery. She pays a large amount of money to have a very, very large memorial put there, which was unusual in its day. It was commented on a great deal. Once again, with poetry, she's written about her children and how she'll never be the same again, which is, when I said she's manipulating, don't forget she's actually murdered them. Mm. So she's gaining all of the sympathy throughout the community that she can possibly gain.
And look like a very loving, grieving mother by having this memorial.
Absolutely. Yeah. She's also putting on a good act throughout the community that she's financially cast, whereas in fact they don't know about the insurance windfall she's been pocketing the whole time.
Mm.
She's actually made herself quite wealthy. She then has two fiancés. So there's two men pretty much on top of each other. One of them a person, Thomas Gilroy, who she'd always been very close to. In between her daughters, a little bit after her daughter's dying, he dies as well. Sudden symptoms, perfectly healthy one moment, next moment he's in hospital, next minute he's dead.
Mm.
So his death's also highly suspicious. Then she finds the man of her dreams, a person by the name of Otto Junken, and she becomes engaged to him, but she never ends up marrying him. And it's her brother-in-law, Lewis, who objects to the marriage amongst all of his family. They think that she's always had a terrible temper.
Mm-hmm.
She then has a bit of a go at murdering Lewis, but pulls back. She decides to pull back, but then she goes on and murders him. Now, the way she was murdering these people is she was lacing their food and drink with arsenic, and she was using a easily obtained rat poison, which was called Rough on Rats.
Mm-hmm.
You could easily buy that at the chemist. You had to sign a poisons book to get it, but she never hesitated to do that. And look, you think about the particularly her children, the little three kids who were just, you know, wandering around playing at her feet. She's gradually poisoning them.
Yeah.
In a way that won't arouse too much suspicion. That took them quite a number of months to die. Female poisoners have often been called black widows in history, and it takes a fairly cruel, sadistic person to do that because it's a pretty awful way to die, and they're just gradually lacing the food and drink enough to make the person gradually sick and gradually drop off and gradually die. So she's effectively got away with murdering her three children, her husband. It looks like she's murdered one of the fiancés, and she's even murdered the brother-in-law. So we're up to five.
Mm.
There's another person in there too that suddenly disappears as well. But then when this Herman Junken objects to her staying at the saddlery, he's going to sell it. It's in Bridge Road. The building's still there. She tries to poison him, and that's when they find enough arsenic in the cup of tea she gives him to kill him five times over.
Oh.
So she's arrested for that, and then the police start to look back on her history. She is a completely famous story. She attracts headlines all throughout Australia. The cable system is such that those articles then appear in international newspapers. Mm. She's known throughout the world and throughout Australia, certainly as the Black Widow. Her court appearances are completely packed out. You can't get in them. There's people clamouring to get a seat if they possibly can. She's become completely famous on the back of these horrible crimes. Part of their investigation is they start exhuming the bodies. The first one they exhume is actually Lewis Junken, the brother-in-law. Now, his body had been taken and buried in South Australia, so they organised to have that exhumed. This is now the biggest story for many, many years in Australian crime. The exhumation at the South Australian Cemetery draws a football-like crowd.
Wow.
Who are all standing around watching.
Oh.
They do the autopsy, and certainly his body, which has been in the ground, I might add, 5 or 5 weeks by the time they're doing this, it's showing signs of arsenic ingestion. They managed to take samples from it, which are later tested, and it's full of arsenic. They then decide to exhume only three of the bodies at Kew Cemetery, the three that are in the same grave, which is her husband, her daughter Elsie, and her daughter May Needle. Once again, it attracts a football-style crowd. It's conducted in a horrible morning when it's all misty and very foggy. You can imagine the scene at the cemetery. Those bodies are all, some of them have been in the ground for years now.
Yeah.
In fact, all of them have been. But they analyse those and find they had arsenic in them as well. So when I said reverse engineering, we're now finding the victims.
Yeah.
Now, if she hadn't have got careless with Herman Junken and handed him a cup of tea with enough arsenic healing five times over, she got away with it.
Mm.
That's the irony of it, is that she's got away with this. And
she would have kept going too, wouldn't she? Could have
kept going,
really?
Yeah. And there's no doubt she would have kept going. There's no doubt there was others in between.
Yep.
Part of Martha's terrible temper and her manipulation is that if anyone stood in her way, she just had a revengeful attitude that would see her take them out. And she threatened her future mother-in-law. She threatened another relative. And she threatened her own mother. At one point she went back and for some mysterious reason visited her mother, even though they hated each other. And her mother fell drastically ill. So
yeah.
At that time it managed to pull through. So she was running around the countryside with this box of Rough on Rats having a wonderful time. So then her court cases take place, and as I said, they're completely crowded out. They dominate the news at that particular time. I mentioned about policing being a bit different in the 1890s, reporting was as well.
Mm.
The reporters we didn't have television and radio, but so the newspapers were everything, and they would jump ahead and try to find witnesses and interview witnesses and come up with theories of their own, and it was like a soap opera.
Mm.
And she's just stuck in the middle of it all while she's sitting in jail. She found a lawyer who was David Gaunson, who was quite a character as well. He'd been the initial lawyer for Ned Kelly, not the final one, but the initial one. And he was also a politician, very, very pugnacious person.
He looks like a politician from the photo in your book.
That would have been
very striking.
Photo. He was, I think, one of the most disruptive politicians in the history of Victoria, not necessarily one of the most effective. He's also had a very, very checkered career as a lawyer as well. He didn't run a very systematic defence. He hated the media, what was in the media, newspapers, so he attacked the newspapers on a daily basis, which didn't do Martha's case much good. Attacked the police, suggested they were all corrupt. He concentrated more on attacking the man rather than the ball. If that makes sense. But look, she had two of the most highly publicised trials that could ever be imagined. There were many, many witnesses, and this all started to come out. But she was only convicted of the murder of Lewis, so that was all that she faced.
Why was that? Just because they, as you said before, they wanted to fast track this. Example to
absolutely
society.
I think if you read the press reports, and some of them are in the book, they were talking of her as being a monster, almost in subhuman terms, even though she wasn't that way. That she wasn't even worthy of the human race, and she needed to be eliminated. And a lot of it was very prejudicial, of course. Before she's actually been found guilty by her all-male jury, who would have been reading all these reports the whole time. But look, then it moves through to the point that she's found guilty and she's sentenced to death by the judge, who was a very, very pompous, upper-crust sort of a judge, who at no point allowed his mind to move into the idea that she might have a mental illness that had caused a lot of this. In true terms, and I'll probably talk about this, her lawyer probably would have been better off going down the line that she had a mental impairment.
Yeah.
But even then she's struggling. She's struggling on a few reasons. She never, ever gave any ground whatsoever that she'd committed any crime. She showed no remorse. She showed no pity for her victims. Mm. All the pity was for herself. Mm. And she even her last letters, the last few things she wrote on the morning she died, were all about herself. So it was all about, I'm sorry I'm going, I know you're going to be all very disappointed about this because you all love me so much. Yeah. It was very much a problem. One of the precursors of an insanity plea, was then called insanity, would have been that she at least gave some ground and admitted some sort of wrongdoing first, and she never did that. But the other thing is, the test of insanity was that she would have been, if he had have put this forward, would have been that her mind was so impaired she didn't know what she was doing at all. Mm. And, you know, we've got high-profile cases at the moment like that, and she's not capable of understanding anything, can't give instructions whether she can plea or guilty or not guilty. She doesn't know what's even going on. The nature of her crimes were very deliberate. They occurred in different locations. They took a long time to pull off, so there was a massive amount of planning involved. Mm. She had to gradually poison her victims. She had to organise insurance policies. Sorry?
Painful deaths.
Painful deaths in front of her. Absolutely.
So it's not an easy way to go.
And then, of course, she didn't go out of her way to get caught. In fact, the opposite. She managed to cover her tracks. Now, all of those things are signs of a person who's of quite sane mind.
Yeah.
A person who's very deliberate in what she's doing. And don't forget, she's collecting insurance monies as well.
Yeah.
She's organised all that very artfully.
Mm.
So that probably wouldn't have succeeded. I suspect, we know a lot more now, of course, and I suspect that she did have some sort of what we would now call an antisocial personality disorder, which unsurprisingly a lot of murderers have that, I would suggest.
We just did an episode recently about personality disorders. I'm thinking about her as well.
But that's not the same as satisfying the test for insanity. So she never really got that off. But the point I made, and I think you made, Emily, as well, that the sort of things that if we were running the case in 2018, we'd raise in mitigation about her childhood. She'd been raped as a child. We know a lot more about traumatic stress disorders. She'd been a victim of domestic violence. She had a drug issue. There's issues about her mental health. We're now talking about the 1890s, and as I've explained before, the politicians involved were very keen to make a real strong lesson to her. And, you know, they were dealing with murdered children here. I can understand that in the most cruel and planned way imaginable. They also wanted to send a message to others, I think, that this sort of behaviour, this is what's going to happen to you. And so that's where it's at. And look, the big thing that the papers mentioned at the time, other than the fact that she was a complete monster, they spoke a lot about what was her possible motive. And, of course, because she never gave any ground, we'll never really know. I suspect it was a lot of things. I suspect that the greed came into it, that the insurance money was very attractive to her. I think also that she was the sort of person who, once someone annoyed her or got in her way of something, that she, her way of dealing with that was to just rid them off the face of the earth as quickly as she could. She wasn't the sort of person, you mentioned the photo on the front cover of the book, you wouldn't want to cross her. That's the day she was arrested.
Yeah, I can't work out if it's sad, but it's also scary, I guess.
She's got a direct stare. And it's funny, as she's being executed, I think 13 journalists witnessed her being executed. She never blinked once. Wow. The only thing they remembered was she scorched them with a stare like that, which just had a mixture of hatred and a mixture of callousness put in it. And when we look at her background and look where she came from and what she'd endured throughout her life, there's a high chance she switched off as a normal human being. Absolutely. As a very young child.
Yeah.
She had no compassion for anyone else other than herself.
Because no one had compassion for her.
That's right, so. Yeah. So there are a part of me feels for – as I was writing the book, I was trying to find something in there that I could say about her that's good. But what I can't do, having studied it for years, is say to you what a lot of people would say, and they try to find a little slither of evidence and they sort of suggest maybe she didn't do it and she's innocent. Mm. No, she did these things.
Yeah.
I have no doubt that she did these things. We'll never quite know why.
Mm.
As a postscript to this, her nephew in the 1920s, her nephew being her eldest sister's son, murdered his family with poison as well.
Oh.
Here's a person by the name of Alexander Newland Lee. His wife and three children were murdered with strychnine, which he put in some milk and fed to them in 1920. He followed almost the same template as her. He signed a book, Poison's book, like Martha did quite brazenly. She was very brazen about all this. Mm. She had planned it well enough. She didn't think she'd ever be caught. And pretty much she hadn't been caught up until she made one mistake. And he was executed in South Australia. So there might be some sort of...
That is an interesting... So I find that with crime stories, is often they go off in little avenues. Now, we've got only a little bit more time, but we did mention now... I always think about this when I hear people on the radio going, bring back the death penalty. You should kill them. You, from your investigations of this, I mean, what do you see as the reality of the death penalty then and why, I don't know, we shouldn't really be so flippant with asking for its return? It's a pretty horrific.
Yeah, no, I've included quite a bit in the book, obviously towards the back, about the death penalty in general as well as this particular execution. And look, the point I made in the book is that I think if we did a straw poll now, Emily, I suggest that a lot of people in the community would say bring back the death penalty. But before you say that, I think you really need to go into it and look at the machinations of it and just realise how barbaric and how ghastly it is. The other thing is that there were some attempts to save Martha. There was a very well-known solicitor in the day called Marshall Lyle. Now, Marshall Lyle wrote petitions to government. He was wasting his time. The politicians had already decided what they were going to do and did it very quickly. In the public records office, there's a petition trying to save Martha's life. A lot of people felt that not only was the death penalty barbaric, but particularly, you know, with a woman. And women had a history of having their sentences commuted to small jail terms, much more so than males. And he wrote a wonderful, wonderful piece as a precursor to this petition, which looked like something that would be written today. And you often hear the phrase ahead of their time. I think he was ahead of his time. And look, what one of the points he made, and we often hear people say that it would act as a deterrent. What we know, looking at the American situation and other data that we have in front of us, it doesn't really act as a massive deterrent at all. It's not a punishment that's even fairly distributed. People who can't afford good lawyers and people in certain groups end up being the victim of it. I don't see that executions are a solution to anything. And if you really study it, and there's a lot in the book about the mechanics of it, so perhaps I'll even mention that. The two people who were involved in her execution were worse criminals, were nearly as bad as she was. They didn't murder anyone, but they were child molesters and, you know, the sort of ragtag people that used to commit these or have these government jobs were amazing. Think of how barbaric this is. I've got a page in the book then. I found a lot of records about her execution. It's very technical in that there's a page in the execution book about Martha Needle. She has to be weighed and measured. They have to figure out how long the rope is. And in the front of the book, they've got, like, in copperplate writing, a little table as to how you execute someone. So how big they are, how tall they are, how much they weigh, how long the rope is, how long the drop will be. All designed to break a human being's neck as quickly as possible. It really is barbaric. In her case, as with the other women, they to avoid the final indignity of her dress flying up over her head as she went through the trapdoor, they put lead in the bottom of her dress. Mm. And I noticed the executioner even added 0.5 pound for the lead when he was calculating how to kill her. And in her case, she was, in terms of mercy, a lot of the old executions were terribly bungled. The person had strangled to death and be kicking there for 25 minutes. In some cases, they were decapitated or half decapitated. Her execution went, it says in the book, went perfectly. Mm. It said that the execution was perfect. Her neck broke straight away. But I don't know how you could write a perfect execution when you actually consider what you're doing. The book also looks at the controversies of capital punishment. And I think anyone who reads that chapter won't feel as though much has been achieved. Martha had almost a suicidal thought pattern in the end. She wasn't all that interested in being in jail the rest of her life, which is where she would have been, or in some sort of an institution. But it was certainly a terribly, terribly sad end. She was only 30 years of age at that particular time. She left a trail of destruction behind her. As I said, she's pretty much a record holder in terms of Australian crime.
It's this book is – it's really – I think I would say it's the definitive story of Martha Needle. I mean, you've spent how many years, would you say, Brian, investigating this?
Yeah, on and off, and you know as a writer yourself, you do other projects in between, but certainly a four-year project
it's
over that time. And look, the passion is what keeps you going, and the passion that I had with this, I mentioned before that I found it is, a fascinating story dealing with a intriguing sort of a character, but I felt the injustice for the victims involved. Mm. That other than Lewis Yunkin, who was found to be murdered, the others have just drifted into history.
Yeah.
Now, the three, I've had, as I said, a fair bit to do with the Burundara Cemetery people. Yeah. And that grave, that family grave, had once been a great ornate memorial. Mm. Because she killed all of her members of her family, she killed off her family tree effectively. So it's now just fallen into a state of, it's just a normal grave site. And look, I've had discussions with one person there about a proper memorial should be there, particularly for the three children involved.
Yeah, and that's the thing. They're so vulnerable. And yes, Martha was vulnerable when she was a child and was terribly abused. But then the abused becomes the abuser. And you're right. It's thinking about the victims in this. And I thought this book was incredible. And it's just I always respect the research process that goes in and the passion. So I really think you've done a great job, and I wish you all the success with this. And Just listeners, go out and read this. Just so much research has gone into this. So congratulations. And
thank you,
I look
Emily.
Forward to your next book.
No, that's right. Well,
have you got something else?
I am working on something else at the moment. Yeah, I'm usually working on something. So perhaps I hope it isn't 4 years. Hopefully we'll be talking a little bit.
We'll have you
then.
Back.
Thank you.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime. And thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars, and to follow us on Facebook.